seriously, you got the, like, your back. You know, you wonder why you have back problems.
I don't have back problems.
You don't have back problems because I fix them.
No, it's because I will maybe someday, but this is how I sat and how my daddy sat and his granddaddy before him.
I guess it's just how you was raised.
That's my cultured heritage.
Welcome to Prefer Not To, a weekly sometime cocktail hour.
Always cocktail hour.
With your hosts, Josh and Kate. I'm not Kate.
I'm not Josh.
Every week, Kate and I have a cocktail, talk about some movies. So, Kate, what is our drink this week?
We are drinking Old Fashions.
And how did we come by drinking the Old Fashions?
Avid listeners of the podcast will probably realize that we've had a huge selection of vermouths and bitters quite some time now, yeah. And I wanted to get rid of the bitters, or to at least use them. Because
yes.
I bought them because they were on sale, and I thought that we were going to be able to use them, and then I haven't yet. So, that's basically what it's
the old leftover hot dog bun problem.
Yep. An Old Fashioned is a dash of, or two dashes of Angostura bitters, one dash of soda water or plain water, just mm-hmm. plain because it varies, one teaspoon of sugar, mm-hmm. and bourbon.
Muddled. You gotta muddle it.
Oh, yeah. Right? Well, you gotta muddle it. But then after you muddle the sugar and the bitters together, you put in ice and then you put in bourbon.
You know, we don't have a muddler, and I always wanted to have one because you look like one of those Keystone cops, like one of those 30s cops.
Well,
you have like
get
a little
one.
Baton.
I thought about getting one after work today, but then yeah. I was really pissed off. So it's like.
Why are you pissed off?
At work. I mean, I was just like. Rrr. It's just like one of those days where, like, all of your complaints about your job come together at once, mm-hmm. and you're just like, God damn it.
So why is it called an old-fashioned?
It's called an old-fashioned because there was a newspaper in Hudson, New York. I've noticed that a lot of our cocktails have to do with newspapers.
I can speak from experience that newspaper men do enjoy their drinks.
Someone wrote into an advice column in 18 to this paper in Hudson, New York in 1806 and asked, what is a cocktail?
1806? 1806?
1806 and asked, what is a cocktail?
Wow, that's old.
And the person who wrote back to him defined it as...
Yeah, it was a very specific. It was like a... It wasn't just like this broad rubric, right?
Right. No, it was a... It's a potent combination of bitters, water, syrup... and spirituous liquor. And so that became known as the old-fashioned. As time went on, people started calling it, you know, they started adding, like, sweeteners, like, you know, your Cointreau and your Triple Sec mm-hmm. and everything else, or, like, water and mm-hmm. sparkling water and stuff. So by the
your
time...
Your grenadines, your creme de menthe.
Right. So by the time in July 1880, the Chicago Tribune was referring to the original recipe as an old-fashioned.
An old-fashioned cocktail. Like,
yes.
Yes. Oh, that makes sense.
It's also one of the main six cocktails.
Right, the base cocktails.
The base cocktails, the other ones of which are the martini, the daiquiri, mm-hmm. the sidecar, the Manhattan, all of which we have tried to enjoy.
We've covered all these bases.
And the Jack Rose, which might be our cocktail for next week, because I've never heard of it.
You rarely hear, that must be like the Zeppo of the original cocktails.
And so I was just thinking that I could read, there's a passage in my cocktail Bible called Old Man Drinks.
What is the name and author of this book?
Old Man Drinks, Recipes, Advice, and Barstool Wisdom by Robert Schneckenberg.
Okay.
And for the old fashioned, he has this to say. This may be the quintessential old man drink. It's so old. It was being called old-fashioned in the 1890s. It's so old. One of the glasses we drank cocktails out of is named after it. It's so old, some scholars believe it was the first drink to be called a cocktail. Oh, I forgot to mention, you can garnish it with a lot of different things.
Right.
We're using a lemon peel because it's mm-hmm. what the recipe called for, but I've also seen, especially on Mad Men, with mm-hmm. maraschino cherries or just an orange slice.
Yeah, although I'm not sure, are those Manhattans or are those old-fashioned?
Old-fashioned.
Because, you know, the cherry sort of screams. Yeah, I guess.
Well,
so, are you enjoying it?
Manhattans are from they're not from bourbon, they're just from whiskey.
No, but you can't look at a drink and tell whether it's bourbon or not.
Well, you can't.
Pretty good. It's you know, it's in that sweet family like the sidecars, and reminds me a little bit of a it's a little whiskey sour, a little sidecar. You don't like yours, do you? You're making a face.
No, I'm looking at you like, what are you talking about?
It's like these drinks that are, they have a whiskey, but they're Swedish.
Oh, yes, yes,
not
yes.
Swedish, like with lutefisk, but sweet. So it's not a tart, it's a sweet one.
So we need to get a muddler. We should have gotten the creepy Halloween muddler when we had the chance. Remember we were at Target and we had like the skull wine cork and like the claws salad mm-hmm. things, and they had a muddler and it had like a...
No, I was too busy looking at the ice strainer.
Oh, it was a strainer. It wasn't a muddler.
Yeah, it wasn't a muddler. It was a little ice strainer. So how was work? You said work was bad?
It's like one of those really stressful days where everyone else, you come in optimistic mm-hmm. and hopeful, and everybody else seems to immediately just make it their personal mission to get you down and to be, and everybody's already in a bad mood, and mm-hmm. then people are
well, you know, at least you weren't the victim of an elaborately conceived grift like the subject of one of our movies in Screen Time this week.
Da, 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 Screen Time. I'm trying to come up with a theme
I may
song.
Actually soundboard that
da, na, na, na. And then I'm gonna re-record it so you can soundboard it. There you go. We should do it together. We should... Na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Screen time! Oh, you can't do it. Like, it has to be like a... Screen time!
So it's like a punchy horn theme.
Or...
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba! Screen time!
I like that. All right, okay. Let's do that again. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba! Screen time!
Okay.
All right, that works.
All right. So, wow, I'm sorry you guys had to experience the experimentation. So, Screen Time is a feature where Kate and I randomly select a number between 0 and 25 and look at...
Hey, when I turn 25, are we going to be able to do it up to 26? Yeah. Oh, shit.
Right. Yeah, I know, right? And add that number to the year that we were born, and then watch the two movies that were number one in America that week in Kate's life and my life.
So this week we had Grease.
We rolled five.
So for this week,
that would have been 1978.
It was Grease. And for me, which was 93 or 94.
What is the year of your birth? 88?
88.
So it would have been 93.
Yeah. We have the...
Malice.
A noir.
Thriller with... Noirish thriller.
Sexual.
With, Nicole Kidman. Alec Baldwin, Bill Pullman, and every single other character actor under the sun.
B.B. Dewarth.
Dude, it's we've had this discussion. This is one of those 6 Degrees of Kevin Bacon Nexus movies.
Mm-hmm,
okay,
mm-hmm.
So who wants to go first?
I think we have more to say about Grease, so I'm going to go ahead and dive into Malice.
Okay, start off with Malice.
All right, so Malice is a, like we just said, is a movie with a lot of early 90s stars as well as some upcoming stars, including one Gwyneth Paltrow. It is a movie that centers around a professor. He's an English professor.
Played by Bill Pullman,
whose wife is Nicole Kidman, who is having a lot of ovarian problems. And as this becomes the forefront, there's also a serial killer at his college for some reason.
There's two parallel plots. There are three. There's the professor and his wife. There's their new neighbor, played by Alec Baldwin.
Right.
And there is a seemingly unrelated plot. Spoilers, it is entirely unrelated. About a serial rapist on campus.
So they're renovating their house and they want to rent the third floor to someone to help pay for it because it's like an old Victorian that's being renovated.
Mm-hmm.
So they rent it out to Bill Pullman's old high school buddy, Alec Baldwin.
Like the top floor, right.
Yeah, the top floor, who is now a really talented OBGYN.
Yeah, right. Harvard-educated OBGYN physician, and yet... apparently has to rent the top floor of a house.
Did they explain that he's renovating a house or something? Well, Bill Pullman.
No, but I mean, like, was Alec Baldwin?
I don't know. The point is that is a loose end. Yeah, and so they move in together. At one point, he's not a great neighbor. He brings home girls at like 3 a.m. and they fuck until like dawn.
Loudly. To Mama Told Me Not to Gum.
And did they really?
Yeah.
I missed that. All right, anyway.
That's a Randy Newman song.
The point being that eventually Nicole Kidman, she has this weird ovarian ailment that she doesn't know about. Eventually she collapses in total pain and has to be taken to the hospital.
Right. She every so often, a la Bart Simpson, she walks around the house going, oh, my ovaries.
So eventually she gets put into the hospital. Dr. Baldwin has to operate on her.
Meanwhile, in the parallel plot, a young girl has been abducted on campus.
And Bill Pullman is being suspected for it
because she was in one of his classes.
Both of the girls who have been abducted were one of his students. So B.B. Newworth shows up and tells Bill Pullman that he needs to go wank off in a bathroom so they can get a sperm sample to prove his innocence. While he's doing that, his wife has an ovarian cyst rupture or something, has to be taken to the emergency room, and Alec Baldwin makes a bad judgment call when he takes out her ovary.
Right.
And it turns out that it wasn't actually necrotic or cancerous or whatever. He was just...
We established before that he was some sort of arrogant surgeon, which doesn't really narrow it down much. But
so the couple wake up, they sue him.
He settles after a long deposition in which he is accused by randomly appearing George C. Scott of having a God complex.
And then he says, I am God.
In an oft-quoted line. Yeah.
And then Nicole Kidman disappears.
She decides she needs to go
think about things, about her marriage, because she had aborted a child during the surgery. And Bill Pullman starts wising up to the antics, I guess. He solves the murder of the disappearing co-eds.
Right, it turns out to be the guy from Saw.
The creepy janitor. And then this is where I get confused, because I'm not sure how they jumped from her going away to her being evil.
Oh, because he learned that he was impotent. He learned that he was not able to have children from the whacking off in the cup.
Yeah, he learned that he was sterile.
Sterile, right.
So how did she get pregnant? Dun, dun, dun.
Bum, bum, bum. So then he first thinks it's her lawyer, played by randomly appearing Peter Gallagher.
Then he thinks that it's, like, you know, Alec Baldwin, and then there's, like, she's disappeared by this point, and the only person he can find who knows anything about her is her mother.
Right. Peter Gallagher then says, look, she said your mother was dead, but her mother's alive. So he goes to visit her souse of a mother, played by randomly appearing Anne Bancroft.
Wonderful.
If you're sensing a theme.
Wonderful Anne Bancroft, but pretty random at the same time. And she gives him all these hints or whatever, and he figures out that he needs to go look up this local doctor, and he does, and finds a forwarding address, and then when he gets to the house of the forwarding address, it turns out that it is Alec Baldwin's house, who was using a pseudonym the whole time.
Right.
And he's having an affair with Nicole Kidman, and she's like, oh, what did she say? She, like, licks his ear, and she's like, fuck me.
Yeah, it turns out, basically, that she is a cradle-raised grifter. He's a doctor who wanted to get revenge on some person or other. I guess George C. Scott.
I think it was George C. Scott.
Yeah.
Because he said that he couldn't be a great doctor.
Right.
Or
and
some
so
shit.
The two of them concoct their scheme. It turns out she was faking her ovary illness using magic drugs.
Some kind of hormone.
Yeah, using plot deviceum.
Yeah, plot deviceum. And then, so it turns into, from there, it spins into this noir kind of thriller where you're trying to figure out what the truth is and who did what and who are these people really. And, you know, will Bull Pullman get to have sex with Nicole Kidman's stunt butt again? And.
Well, yeah, we'll get to the stunt
the
butt.
The point is that it just kind of unravels.
It piles on the reverses and the coincidences.
And the twists.
And the red herrings to such an extent that you have no investment in it anymore. A movie can be suspenseful without having plot twists.
Yep.
But a movie that is all plot twists can lack suspense entirely.
Yeah, because the most coherent part of the movie is the first 30 minutes before any plot twists happen.
Right.
Like, that's the part I could describe to you, but then after that I'm like, well, wait, what has happened? What is she doing? And it's not because I was drinking, although I was. I'm just saying that it was a really incomprehensible movie.
No, it was, yeah. I joked to you that the name of this movie could have been Red Herring the Motion Picture.
Yeah.
Because it really was just one red herring after another. And especially when you cast so many recognizable faces, and I realize that's part of, like, the jerk in your chain bit, where it's like, well, they wouldn't have just cast George C. Scott if he's some sort of schlub.
Except,
well, guess what?
They did.
Right. They wouldn't have cast Anne Bancroft if it was just in a role where she showed up for one scene to chew the scenery and get drunk, and yet they did.
Plus the art direction and everything about the directing, everything about this movie, it just comes off so Lifetime movie of the week. It was. It was very, very reminiscent. Like, just everything about it, it looked like so Friday night of the special, like, I don't even know, Penelope Ann Miller in The Forgotten Garden or something, like, you know, and it turns out to be a story about her autistic son who is, it's like one of those things where, like, these old actresses go, like, and at the same time, like, actresses who have no, like, but, you know, it's like that, that's the kind of feel that it came off with.
Marcia Gay Harden is under the microscope. Because, you know, she's like a scientist, but someone's stalking her.
Yeah, or, yeah, exactly. Or she,
right.
Yeah, okay.
It's like her coworker, or like a graduate student who takes credit for her work, but he's also stalking her.
That could work. That could work. I don't know. It was just very, like, it just had that feel to it. It felt cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it wasn't entertaining, even though it was entertaining in the whole, like, what the fuck am I watching?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, I just think it was red herring the motion picture. Just a lot of twists. You know, once a movie twists too much, and it's the same problem that I have with a lot of horror. It's that once it throws too much at you.
All right. Anyway, so about this movie, it was entertaining, even though it was kind of like, what the fuck is going on? It was ambitious. It had a lot of good talent in it that I think it just kind of, like, it was just a shitty plot. They read the lines wonderfully. I mean, it was well acted. It was just like, what the fuck is going on?
But yeah, a lot of, there's a high-powered acting in this
movie.
Yeah,
and you've got peak Alec Baldwin.
Mm-hmm.
Like, delicious Alec Baldwin. Yeah. Like,
Bill Pullman at prime beta male Pullman before he embarked on Independence Day stardom.
Yep. And then Nicole Kidman looking wonderful.
Yeah, just divine.
Yeah, before she, you know, changed her face.
And also, anybody who hates Gwyneth Paltrow, this is before she grew into her face, so she looks like a human being, and it's great.
She's really awkward, and she's wearing clothes that you're like, you know, today she looks back and goes, oh.
I wouldn't use those to shammy my iPad.
So that was malice for me.
Yeah, I just, you know, it was one of those things where, like, when Alec Baldwin was on the screen, and it's partly because I will watch him do almost anything. But it's not...
Even before you figure out, like, you know that something's going on with Alec Baldwin and Nicole Kidman's character, there's a lot of really random, like, times where he'll just come into their house and stare at her.
Right. It's like, dude, you're
like,
in
there's this. There's this one scene where she's, like, in her bathroom, like, she just had, like, an ovary attack, and she's, like, sitting on the edge of the bathtub, like...
she's got a case of the ovaries.
She's, like, holding her stomach going, oh... And then Alec Baldwin just appears out of nowhere and comes in and, like, stares at her with this piercing glance. She goes, and you're like, and then it just, they never really go anywhere from that. It's apparently treated it completely normally. Like,
so Malice, you know. Eh. Yeah. So everybody in the world has seen Grease, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
So 70s musical phenomenon Grease. Broad strokes, Danny and Sandy meet in the summer.
Two kids in high school.
And then they come back to Rydell High, which is in California, but apparently everybody's a greaser, which I don't get, but whatever. And it's like no surfers at all, even though it's late 50s in California. So suddenly, even though she's suddenly from Australia, she shows up at school. Greasers and everybody sings a lot of songs. Stacker Channing is wonderful. In the only role that the only person who seems like a human. Well, no, Didi Khan in the little Frenchie role. Yep. She's wonderful too. And a lot of really old people playing teenagers.
Yep.
Then they sing. Olivia Newton-John is Sandy. John Travolta is Danny.
They go through various mishaps. And
they learn to embrace different roles in their lives.
Apparently.
And then sing to one another and...
we go together. Okay.
So my first memory, by the way, of this musical was... the Leibowitz sisters, who lived up the street from us, like up at the top of the hill when I lived in Gainesville, they had a copy of the soundtrack, and I hadn't seen the movie. Because I was like, you know, whatever, 6 or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, unlike people today, I'm a responsible adult. They ain't gonna take me to see fucking Grease. I would like to think it's because it sucks, but it's probably just because they were the word pussy wagon is in it. But we would listen to this tape over and over again, and this was before I knew anything about music. So, like, my impression was that this is what music in the 50s was like. And it's not. And this is, like, my whole beef with this play and this movie is that it's, like, at the cusp of, and there was a peak of it in the 70s, and then it sort of went away for a while.
And then it came back
in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Back to the
gone.
Future.
Well, that's different. That's a little different, but hold on. And then it's sort of been back ever since because boomers had a lot of money. But the sort of meta nostalgia of you know, things like Beatlemania and Grease and Happy Days, where it's these sort of stylized renditions of an idealized baby boomer 50s and 60s,
yeah,
which bear no resemblance to what it actually was. And the thing that really drives me nuts now is that you have people who are nostalgic for Grease. So they're nostalgic for something that was already manufactured nostalgia.
Are you sure they're just
to
not,
begin with?
Are you sure they're just not fans of the musical or the movie? However misguided that might be.
But seriously, I think there are people who, you know, if they don't think about it, think that Grease is the 50s instead of a movie from the 70s.
I do remember the first time I watched it, I was watching it on like VH1 Classic Rewind or something. And my mom, who was born in 54, I asked her, I was like, oh my gosh, is this what your childhood was like? And she's like, sweetie, I was a kid in the 50s. Like, you know, I wasn't aware or sentient really until like the 70s. Mm-hmm. And that just always struck me as like, it's that exactly what you said. It's that time that everyone's like, if someone thinks 50s for Halloween or a costume party, they look at Grease.
But it's like, right, and it's not even, but right, and it doesn't, the 50s were not like that. It's this bizarre, weirdo, Grease alien planet of the 50s. You know, there's no, like, there's two, basically three cliques, which is the Pink Ladies, the Greasers,
I'm sorry. Cliques?
Yeah.
Cliques?
Yeah.
That's how you say that word?
That's one of, you can say click, you could say clique.
I've never heard clique before. Cliquity clique, clique, clique.
Anyhow.
Sorry,
There are several groups of students, but it's basically just these greasers and these pink ladies, and then everybody else is just sort of this undifferentiated mask of pigtails and bobby socks. And
jocks, like the jocks
right,
are a solid
and letter
group.
Sweaters.
Yep, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is not... You know, it is in no way representative of, you know, I wasn't alive then, but I'm reasonably confident, given that my high school experience was slightly more diverse than that.
Didn't go to high school in the 50s, did you?
That's also
true. No black people.
You know what? That's not the only metric of diversity. So, you know, but my point is that there's this weird, and you know, but that's my point, is that people think the 50s was Grease, that the 50s was Happy Days, when in fact those cultural artifacts reflect much more the period in which they were created, which is the late 1970s, just like Back to the Future reflects much more the period in which it was created, the mid-80s, than it does the period that they are trying to describe.
Well, does
that... As you know, all cultural artifacts do.
Does that mean that Hot Tub Time Machine reflects the morals of the aughts instead of...
morals.
Or the time and flavor of the aughts instead of...
Right. I just, you have to look at it not as something, you know, as something of its time. Not of the 50s, and I think, you know.
I want to watch Hot Tub Time Machine now.
Okay, whatever.
I agree with you, and to a point, I don't think I'd ever realized before we watched this together that the only songs from the 50s play during, like, the dance scene where they all do, and that's when you hear Tears on My Pillow.
Right. Well, not only that, they create, like, shitty knockoff 50s songs. Like, that Rock and Roll Is Here to Stay song is just a shitty knockoff of At the Hop.
Yeah.
My point is just, I think a lot of people mistake, and, you know, maybe I'm accusing people of being dumb. Also, I just find it weird how much older these people are than the high school students they're portraying.
Yeah. I mean, there's only like three characters, and they're side characters. They're 19, which is still out of high school.
Right. But like, Staggered Channing is what, 34 in this movie? When she's making this movie?
She was like 30 something.
I think she was like 34 when she made this movie.
And we did the math. She's born in 44.
We did the math. She's only about 2 years away from being the actual age of the character that she is playing. Would have been in 1977.
Yeah, wow.
You know?
Yep. Maybe that's why she was right for the role.
Right. She could remember.
Come on, girls.
Well, that's the other thing. Like, I love Staggered Channing. I think she's wonderful. But she is, in her very bones, the character that she plays in Six Degrees of Separation, this sort of Northeastern patrician girls' school type.
Yep.
And for her to play this sort of greasy character was just, you know, I think it's wonderful, but it is totally out of left field and doesn't always work.
Yeah, well, she's the best thing about this movie.
Absolutely, far and away the best thing about this movie. And Olivia Newton-John, whenever she's on the screen, you're like, hey, it's Olivia Newton-John. She's looking, being all perky
and
exciting.
She's cute, yeah.
You know, she's got energy. And John Travolta, I guess he's got energy, you know, I just don't like this music. And also, it's a shitty musical. Like, the songs suck.
They're terrible.
Like, the songs really, really suck.
The only song that I do like from this production is That's the Worst Thing That I Could Do.
Yeah, because it's an interior monologue story that advances the plot of the character.
Yeah, it's
which
also...
most of the other songs do not do.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
It harkens back to a different age of musicals, of pre-Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals.
I don't like Grease either, but it's for completely different reasons.
Honestly, I would rather have been watching Grease 2.
Grease 2 has a hot guy in it.
Yeah, it has the guy from Empire Records.
Oh my god, that's him.
Maxwell Caulfield.
Holy shit. It's
you
the
know
same
that?
Guy.
Yeah, you know, it's also got Adrian Zmed from fucking Hooker's a Good Cop.
Well, I knew that. I'm just saying that I find Grease to be an extremely have extremely offensive messages.
Yeah, I think you oversold a lot of those, but I think the Staggered Channing arc is actually a pretty good one, except for the complete emergency, whoop, never mind, I'm not pregnant at the end.
Well, there's that whole plot where the point is that she becomes pregnant or thinks that she's pregnant, and her boyfriend completely ditches her.
Well, you know, he is Jeff Conway.
And apparently they get back together.
Like, hit your wagon to a rising star there.
They get back together the day she says, hey, I'm not pregnant anymore. Or it was a false alarm. Mm-hmm. But my main complaint becomes from the main romance involving Danny and Sandy, mm-hmm. which is that they're clearly not good together.
Yeah.
They're always trying to change the other person. And it finally, the happy ending is when she sluts
when
it
they
up.
Both change. Yeah, when they both decide they have to be completely different people for the other one to like them. I'm like, okay.
Well, that's problematic. It's extremely problematic.
But I don't think it's the anti-feminist message that you think it was, because he changes just as much and goes and runs track and shit.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, they're driving off in his Grease Lightning pussy wagon together.
Flying off.
And his pussy wagon together. And she has become, what finally settled it is she decides that she can't be with him unless she changes herself. And he doesn't have to do anything.
Well, but
he stays stupid Danny Zuko, who's walking around in greaser pants and like all this stuff, and she's the one that's in fucking black pleather at the end of the school year.
You know, at
going,
a certain point,
tell
many
me
people,
about it, stuff.
At a certain point, many people who are teenagers do in fact experiment and change with new personas.
Exactly.
It's not like a
but
crazy
this, no,
notion.
It's not, but this is what is presented as the happy ending for them to get together and for them to literally fly off into paradise. Yeah, she has to become a slut. And I resent that.
I think she's
fuck you, Grease. The plot point is that you have to change yourself.
You need to stop slut shaming Sandy.
You need to change yourself to be with someone, which is such bullshit. Such a horrible, toxic message.
But you know, that's the message of every movie ever. That's the message of every movie where the girl takes off her glasses and becomes insanely beautiful.
That's not changing herself.
Anne Hathaway becoming a fucking princess.
That's not changing yourself or compromising yourself.
That's exactly the same message.
No, she's the one who's like, she's like this little cupcake queen who's
right.
So
she's
sweet.
She's a little mousy librarian who then lets down the hair.
I'm talking about Olivia Newton-John. It's like she can't like smoke a cigarette or she can't even get her ears pierced without passing out.
I know the words to the song.
I'm just saying that it's bullshit and it's a horrible movie and I hate it. I'm just saying my favorite character is Rizzo, who is in fact the pro-sex lady.
Yeah, but then you... Okay. It's not a good movie.
No, it's not. And it treats women like accessories.
You know, I call movies out on women's issues all the time. I just don't think that's... I think that's more of a function of this movie just being poorly written and bad than it is of any sort of active lack of understanding or empathy for the female characters. All right, so we got to roll our numbers. Let's take a break and roll our numbers for next week. We'll talk about it. Okay, so we're back. The year that we rolled was 13, correct?
Yep.
So for me, that would mean the year 1986, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And for you, it was 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And what were our movies, Kate?
Our movies were Crocodile Dundee for Josh and Training Day for me.
Well, all right. So how's the old-fashioned treating you?
It's good. Again, there's a weird mixture of sweet to sour that I think with a lot of our cocktails, I have not yet mastered, like, the balance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the appropriate one. So it's a little more sour and bitter than sweet. I feel like it should be more drinkable, but I don't,
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Hey, what'd you think of the Breaking Bad finale?
I thought it was good. Like, I really don't know what else to say about it. I think that it kept up the suspense until the end, and it satisfied the ending. I mean, it did justice to the whole series all at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would give it a B+. A- maybe.
Yeah, I would give it an A-. I mean, like, it was...
My only complaint is that it was just, you know, it played it real safe, but it was satisfying in,
exactly.
in the way it played
exactly.
it safe.
It played it safe, and then, like, Walter randomly redeemed himself kind of in his own eyes, which
mm-hmm. if it hadn't had that discussion where Walter admitted that he was doing it for himself, then
that
I think
was
it
great
paid.
That was a yeah. great scene. I'm just talking about the idea that he felt the need to save Jesse when like two episodes ago he hated Jesse.
That seemed random. Like I think they could have sold harder that him seeing the Schwartzes on Charlie Rose toggled something in his mind. You know, I think that's in order, and they I think they sold it okay, but it was just a little I didn't see it coming, that part. But then the rest of the episode was, I thought, you know, I played it pretty safe.
I thought it was a little, yeah, exactly. I was expecting to be a lot more bloody. I was expecting, like, everybody to die.
I was just expecting, you know, if this is from the show that has given us, you know, the pink teddy bear in the swimming pool for an entire season, or, you know, the fly episode. This was, you know, playing it safe. I wanted something more like the Sopranos finale, I'll be entirely honest. Something that was thought-provoking and challenging and talking to the issues. And I think it sort of did, but, you know, I liked it. I'm sounding more negative about it than I really am. I thought it was satisfying. It was good. I don't think it let the show down at all.
Yeah, I don't know what else they would have done, really, but, like, something about Walter... Okay, spoilers, everybody. Something about Walter just dying because of a random gunshot wound seemed a little, like, too on the nose, and I don't know. I mean, it ended the way it could have. Like,
I do like the way that they used the Marty Robbins song, El Paso, because
yes.
The idea of him... I mean, the whole song is about a guy going back into a bar to rescue a girl that he loves, and then dying in her arms, and I like how meth was his girl that he died in the arms of, like in the song. And I thought that was cute.
It's funny because I was reading an interview with Vince Gilligan recently and they said something about how the plot resembles The Searchers.
A little bit, yeah. The difference being, you know, I mean, if you haven't seen The Searchers, but the Natalie Wood character doesn't want to be rescued.
Yeah.
I think Jesse clearly wants to be rescued.
Well, it depends on saying something that Vince Gilligan said.
No. I agree.
The
Searchers is the most ripped off plot pretty much in movie history. It's up there. There's lots of movies that are just The Searchers. You know, which is, you know, it's one of my favorite movies, so it's not like, you know, it's a bad thing to be. But so what else is new on TV this season? You have any new shows that you really like?
I'm really excited for The Originals.
At least it's not on opposite. Well, it's on, you know, it's going to be on opposite Parks and Rec.
I'm okay with that. Mostly because I'll probably end up watching one or the other the next day anyway.
On Hulu, right. Yeah. Especially because it's Christmas. You're going to be working late.
Yep. Yes, it is Christmas and it is October 1st.
Yeah, what else are we watching? We watched Survivor. Anything you liked on Survivor this season so far?
I love Survivor to begin with. I think I'd rather either have a whole cast of new people or a cast of all favorite people.
Well, at this point, they're almost never going to do one that's all new people.
Why?
It's just the way you haven't noticed that? I mean, it's been 10 seasons. They've always had at least like one seed of, someone or like the guy who was relatives of Russell Hance or, they've always got some connection.
I don't mind there being like a twist where it's like, oh, these are all new people, but secretly they're all, I don't know. I just don't like the whole, like half of the tribe or the other tribe is just people that I'm not invested in because I like the favorites. I don't know. I mean, the return people.
I can't help thinking like if the spouses and friends were like that telegenic, one of two things would have happened. Rob Burnett would have picked them the first time or, they would have gone on the Amazing Race. Also, it's kind of like the Survivor trying to do an Amazing Race type thing where you have like teams of two.
Except they're not working together. They're working against each other.
Except there has like to be some six. Kind of rule. I mean, if you're a married couple, the rules in Survivor say that you can't offer people the money to vote for you. So there'll have to be some alteration later on. Just for those of you who are not following Survivor this season, it's basically half the contestants are former people who have been on the show and half the contestants are friends of those or relatives something of those. They'll have to change the rules somehow to make it so that it's not some kind of money giveaway type thing. Like when Rob and Amber won and then got married and got all the money.
Yeah, well, can you blame them?
Yeah, they're both really kind of despicable people.
Yeah, but they're much richer than you or I.
Is that your metric for goodness?
No, I'm just saying, like, can you blame them for doing something like that when...
Right. So my favorite thing so far on Survivor this season, one of the returning contestants is from the very first season of Survivor.
Oh, well, I know what you're going to say.
Jervis, who was in the original, Rudy Bosch, Richard Hatch, Susan Hawk season. Jervis was not in the winning alliance. He was sort of just one of these random hangers-on.
He went out like, what?
He was in the final... Was he on the jury? I don't remember.
I think he was on the jury.
Although
to be fair, when we watched that season, I was like in a weird, like, I'm sick, I'm throwing up everything in my body. I was in that. That was where I was at. I was like, oh, I'm just getting over horrible stomach illness. Everything is very hazy. I don't think I've had enough water to sustain life.
It's interesting that you mentioned having enough water because another person who has problems with water is Jervis. So those of you who watched season one 15 years ago may recall that Jervis's defining quality was that he could not swim. And he would say this in more than one episode, that I hope this challenge doesn't involve swimming. Black people don't swim. I don't swim. I mean, he was like the original reality show black people don't swim guy, which, by the way, every reality show now has one of these. There's been like tons of them on Amazing Race. Apparently, like, they have to cast a black person who bitches about swimming.
I think in like most interviews, they'll be like, hi. Hi. How are you?
Well, I've got an MBA from Harvard.
Yeah.
And, I didn't want to really pursue business, so I went into charitable giving.
Okay, well, can you explain to me how your ethnicity has affected your position?
Go near the water.
All right.
But again, the charitable work I do is very important, but as a black man, I will not go near the water.
How do you get your exercise? Do you swim? You look like you've got a swimmer's
body. I do not swim. So Jervis was the original one of these guys.
Yeah.
And then in the interview, he comes back on Survivor. The very first challenge that they have is like a race out, a swimming race out, and the guy is swimming and gulping water. In the following 15 fucking years, he has done two things that I know of. One, applied to get back on Survivor again.
Yep.
And B, strenuously avoided learning how to swim.
My thing has always been, if you're going to be on Survivor, why wouldn't you brush up on these random skills, like how to build a fire, how to swim? Like, why wouldn't you just like go running every day?
How not to breathe smoke in and fall over in a fire in your face?
Why wouldn't you learn how to swim? Like all these things, like what, what's going to happen at this point?
I think you don't want to give off the stink of competence because then there's no way that the producers will pick you.
I'm saying like once you've been picked, time period between when you've been picked and when the shooting
that
starts?
So that's Survivor. I thought it was hilarious. It's Jervis bitching about swimming. It's like going on an Amazing Race and being afraid of heights. There's always some team that does it. And it's like the first damn episode, you're going to have to base jump off a bridge.
Yep.
It's every freaking Amazing Race.
That's why I'm not going to be on Amazing Race.
It's like, it's also like not knowing how to drive a stick and be on the Amazing Race. Consistently, people go on the Amazing Race not being aware that every place else in the world, when you rent a car, it's a stick.
At a certain point with all reality TV shows, like that serial reality TV shows where there's been multiple seasons, there's always those things that contestants just refuse to do that they know they're going to have to do. It's like on America's Next Top Model, the episode where they have to do their makeovers and change their hair and get hair cut off or dyed or whatever. There's always like at least one cast member who's like, I'm not going to do it. My hair is my identity. And it's like, at this point, you should know better.
Well, and in defense of those people, they barely have any identity to begin with. So it may very well be in their hair, Samson style.
On Amazing Race, it's like Heights, on Survivor, it's...
But Amazing Race generally has a group of pretty competent people, by and large. You know, I mean, these are... I know I over-defend Amazing Race, but I think it's a great show.
In general, with long-running TV shows, reality TV shows, there's always something that someone's going to take offense to that they should have learned to deal with before they got on the show.
Who I miss?
It's like any dating show, like The Bachelor or anything that you have like that, where they're like,
I can't believe he's making out with another girl. Right.
Why do they call it a sanitary napkin? Because honestly, once it's been used, it's the least sanitary thing in the world.
I'm sorry, have you ever menstruated before?
I'm not saying that menstruation is unpleasant, although I'm given to understand that it is. I'm saying as a euphemism, sanitary napkin is among the most clinical and impersonal that I could think of. It's not like they call it, you know, what would they call it? Like, she liner. You know, although they have a lot of great names now.
There's a lot of really random euphemisms for ladies' products that they use. Just like on purpose. They don't call it a pad or a blood catcher. They call it a sanitary napkin. And there's a reason that it comes in like
They don't call them those in commercials anymore though.
There's a reason that in packaging it comes in like flowers and like swirls and like, you know, your tampons are packaged as like fresh.
I get a funny story about that.
All right, go ahead.
Also, by the way, how do you decide like what you're going to use? Like, you know, I know you're a belt and suspenders kind of lady for your times. But like, is there how many brands do you try? How many different arrangements before you're like, hey, this is going to work for me? I feel like maybe there are a lot of women out there who just like went in one day when they were 14 with their mom and then just they never thought about it again.
I think that's probably pretty true. My mom was always a Kotex gal, so I'm a Kotex gal.
I wonder if that's why it's so hard for new brands to break in, because it's so much of a like mom handed this down to me kind of thing. Like, I'm trying to think of the last new brand. I remember when they came out with OB, that was really big.
That was big. Your question is just like why we choose like, the how ones much that we
shopping,
choose.
Right, how much shopping around did you do? And does it change over your life? I mean, I imagine that your flow cycles change over the course of your life, so you might try to use different products.
No, I don't think so, because I've pretty much consistently chosen Kotex. I've always been a Kotex person. I don't like Always because they're just way too much. I like Kotex.
Even within that the brand, do you change? Do you change up? Or do you just pretty much stick with the same?
Well, you know, they introduced the You by Kotex recently.
Right.
Like a couple of, like maybe like 3 or 4 years ago. And I started, eventually, I bought that, my first package of that, because it was cheap. I think it was on sale. Like, it was the cheapest thing, and so I bought it because also I like Kotex. I will say that I start off with, like, your baseline Kotex. I've experimented with sizes, with, like...
Because I didn't buy condoms till I was in college.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, this is different, because this is something you have to buy for.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, like, your mediums versus your, like, light days, and you technically put it outside of your business. Unless
I can't actually put anything into my damn business. I mean,
My point.
If I put things in my... Kate, if I start putting things in my business, if I start... Seriously. You do not need my permission to seek help.
Basically, I've always stuck to a couple of brands. Mm-hmm. Basically, if I had a bad experience with one... Like, I've never been a big fan of Tampax for tampons. I tried different brands. I tried, like, the slim version of Tampax and stuff like that. Not so great. And then I did this really weird foray into Playtex. Did not like that either. And now I'm back to, I'm a solid Kotex person.
Well, sure. You know, in college, everybody experiments.
No, this was, like, middle school. Oh, God, this is so embarrassing.
Like, once I found a condom that was fine, I won't change brands.
There's a difference, because I guess the answer to this is that I really like Kotex. In terms of, I think I've had more problems with tampons than with pads. Although the thing with pads is that they've got a lot of different lengths and thickness and, like, absorbency. And at a certain point, you don't want to feel like you're wearing a diaper. Tampons are different, though, because a lot of tampons are, like, scented or they're extra thick. thick, or they're like the super brand or something like that. And I don't know. Tampons are wonderful. Pads are wonderful. You guys, unless you're a woman, you probably will never understand. Well,
no, here's the story. Here's the story that I have. I once dated someone mm-hmm. who was, this was very early on, before it even had the name Diva Cup, mm-hmm. right? It was something really not, it was like Earth Mother Ball right, or
it,
some
but
shit.
But it was the idea that you right. put it up in your snatch.
Right. And it was made of rubber. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and I don't even know what they look like right now, because I only know this from back when I dated.
They look like a cone.
Yeah, no, I mean, I know shape-wise, but like, you'll get to what I'm going okay. for here in a sec. So, you know, I was not familiar with this product at the time. It was brand newish. So she had it, and like, at this time, and I'm given to understand it's changed, it was like this gross brown red brick color, like a really thick vulcanized rubber, and it had like no case or anything. Like, you just carried it around like in a Ziploc or something. And I said to her, these are the things that this product is going to have to do to be successful. You're going to have to change that disgusting red brick color because it already looks like menstrual blood.
Now it is, in fact, a, like, nude
right. kind of... This is what, like, I'm telling you.
You know, the color of, like, of latex for it, gloves.
I know. Wait for it, Kate. So you're going to have to change that disgusting red brick color. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to give it a really dainty little case so people can carry it around in their purse.
Mine had a pouch.
There you go. See? Right. And third, I swear to you, you're going to have to give it a cute name. And they gave it the Diva Cup name. I swear to God, everything that I said they had to do for this product to make it succeed, they did, and now look at them.
Now look at them go.
Yeah, this is why I'm unemployable. I'm functionally the guy who came up with the Diva Cup.
No, that is not true at all.
Okay, now's the part of the show where we do a little housekeeping. I don't have any housekeeping, do you? Okay, no? I did want to thank our friend, my college buddy Josh, for mentioning the show on his Twitter feed and giving us a nice plug and indicating that he's enjoying the show. I hope that's still the case. Keep listening, man, and I promise I will buy the joiners when it comes out, spend all my money on, and get those 3D goggles. So now's the part of the show also when we do recommendations. I think Kate's going to go first because she's excited about whatever it is that she's recommending, and I have no idea what that in fact is. So
okay, so I'm going to go ahead and recommend Friday the 13th Part 4, the final chapter. This is the fourth installment in the 1980s series. It bills itself as the last chapter, but is in fact not the last chapter, judging by the fact that they made like 8 more movies. I just particularly like it because it's the perfect mixture between goofy and scary, if there is such a thing. And it is, in fact, the perfect treat for the Halloween season for all audiences. It also stars Crispin Glover, if that sways you any other way. So it's a wonderful mix between campy, goofy, and scary. So if you're looking for a Halloween treat to serve all kinds, this is what I would recommend. This is Friday the 13th, Part 4. The final chapter.
That's an interesting recommendation. I don't think I've seen that one, so I will take that under your advisement. So my recommendation is there's a PBS series about a local chef here in North Carolina. It's called A Chef's Life, and it's airing probably on your local public television station. It's about she was a cook or a chef in New York City, and she and her husband came back to North Carolina to start a farm-to-table restaurant out in the boonies of Kinston, North Carolina. And it's all the story about her sort of learning more about North Carolina food and Southern food, and trying at the same time to sort of run a pretty high-end-ish restaurant in a really small pokey town out in eastern North Carolina. And along the way, she gives you some great food tips and some recipes. It's shot really well, and it's a flavor of my home state, so I recommend that. You can either watch it on PBS or on the PBS website or on your streaming device if there's a PBS channel. It's called A Chef's Life. I highly recommend it. So the recommendations this week from Kate, Friday the 13th, Part 4, the final, not final, chapter. And from me, the PBS not quite cooking show, A Chef's Life. Kate, did you enjoy the old fashions this week?
I think I enjoyed them a little too much.
So for Kate, I'm Josh.
And for Josh, I'm Kate.
And we look forward to spending some time with you again next week.
Okay, thank you for listening.